I can shave within 30 seconds before I go on television and still have a beard, he lamented to television journalist Walter Cronkite 2 weeks ago. The 47-year-old presidential candidate wears a light gray suit for this televised presidential debate. It has been yet another long day on the campaign trail, and Nixon is exhausted. He has just lost 20 pounds after suffering a staphylococcus infection in his left knee that required a hospital stay. Between August 29th and September 3rd, he was laid up in Walter Reed Army Medical Center, the injured leg immobilized by traction weights as antibiotics were administered to battle the infection. Then, shortly after his release, Nixon endured a crippling bout of flu from which he has not completely recovered. This combination of light suit, pale face, and wan complexion gives Nixon a sallow and unhealthy appearance. My God, Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley exclaims at the televised sight of Nixon. They've embalmed him even before he died. The next morning, Nixon's mother will call to inquire about her son's health. Now, Richard Nixon perches on the edge of his chair, legs splayed, left hand betraying his anxiety by flitting nervously from an armrest to his lap and back again. His eyes also shift, as Nixon is unsure whether to stare into the camera lens or at his opponent. Making matters even worse, he bumped his bad knee hard against a car door as he arrived at the CBS Broadcast Center in Chicago for tonight's debate. The pain radiates up and down his leg, even as Nixon unsuccessfully tries to appear at ease. Opposite the vice president, looking the very picture of health, is John F. Kennedy. The Democratic candidate for president sits calmly, legs crossed, hands folded in his lap. Journalist Howard K. Smith moderates the debate from a desk placed between the two candidates. The endocrine disorder known as Addison's disease, which causes Kennedy so much pain, also has the positive side effect of making his skin glow with a healthy tan. Kennedy takes steroids to combat this degenerative condition, which have added a few pounds to his 175-pound frame, imbuing JFK with a strong and rugged look. The boyishly handsome Kennedy's blue suit and greenish-gray eyes make him appear a decade younger than his opponent, though their actual age difference is just 4 years. And unlike Nixon's long day of donor speeches and campaign appearances, JFK has spent the entire weekend holed up in a hotel suite with his staff, resting and preparing answers to potential questions. This is a great country, but I think it could be an even greater country, Kennedy says in his opening remarks. He stares directly into the camera lens with an unwavering gaze. JFK's hair is parted perfectly, and his patrician Boston accent makes him sound confident instead of just rich. This is a powerful country, but I believe it could be even more powerful. Richard Nixon quickly echoes those opening lines, stating, I subscribe completely to the spirit that Senator Kennedy has expressed tonight. There are 100 million Americans following the debate, some listening on the radio while others watch on television. Those who could not see the candidates will later agree that the final result is a toss-up between Nixon and Kennedy. But the 70 million TV viewers will overwhelmingly choose Kennedy as the winner. 1960 is a time when a frivolous-minded America is enthralled with the hula hoop and singers like teen sensation Fabian. But beneath that escapist exterior, the nation is frightened. The United States is in the midst of a Cold War for world domination with the Soviet Union. Communist Cuba's Fidel Castro is said to be aligning with the Soviets just 90 miles south of the American mainland. And the civil rights movement is sparking radical division between blacks and whites in America. It is a turbulent year, and some see Senator Kennedy as the answer, a politician capable of standing up to USSR leader Nikita Khrushchev. In Vice President Nixon, many viewers see a nervous man with a gray pallor and perspiration leaving trails through his makeup as the sweat rolls down his face. As the debate continues for the next hour, both candidates articulate their policies with intelligence and clear knowledge of the subjects. Each is well aware that Election Day is just 6 weeks away. Pollsters are currently calling the race a draw. Tonight is very much about appearances, but the truth is that most viewers will vote along party lines, no matter how ill at ease Richard Nixon may appear. So each candidate seeks the slight advantage that will lead to victory. Which is why, after apparent setbacks with Senate hearings, the Appalachian summit, and the FBI's forced acknowledgement of organized crime, the mafia now rises stronger than ever. Hoodlums like Chicago's Sam Giancana, Tampa's Santo Traficante, Teamster boss Jimmy Hoffa, and even the incarcerated Vito Genovese secretly possess the power to influence who will be the next occupant of the White House. In fact, the mafia in America now has few adversaries on the federal level, so its power is almost unchecked. And as always, the mob is looking for new ways to make money, as well as influence not only the political landscape, but also the social tempo of America. At the dawn of the 1960s, that means rock and roll. Disc jockey Alan Freed coined that term after bringing his radio program to New York City's WINS Radio. Previously based in Cleveland, the 38-year-old Freed rose to fame playing rhythm and blues records, formerly popular only with black audiences. Freed used the alter ego Moondog as he opened the mic to howl along with the music, speaking to his audience in hipster patois. But as Alan Freed transfers his act to New York, he is sued by another artist who goes by the name Moondog. After losing the case and being forced to pay $6,000 as well as being banned from using the name ever again, Freed is forced to rename his show. He settles on Alan Freed's Rock and Roll Dance Party, well aware that most white Americans will not understand the reference. Since black singer Trixie Smith released the song My Man Rocks Me with a Steady Roll in 1914, the term rock and roll has become a frequently used euphemism for sex in black neighborhoods. Though Bill Haley and his Comets' hit single Rock Around the Clock should have clued in many listeners to the illicit nature of rock and roll music, this mixture of rhythm and blues, gospel, and country music is seen as a threat to the American way of life for other reasons. Unlike crooners such as Andy Williams and Perry Como, whose soothing tones are a holdover from Frank Sinatra's 1940s heyday, the edgy nature of rock performers encourages a sense of teen rebellion. And unlike the large orchestras featuring musicians in suits and ties, a typical rock and roll band is a singer backed by guitars, drums, and sometimes piano or a saxophone, each displaying their own frenetic energy. In this way, the entire band generates a following, not just the lead singer. But most controversial is the fact that rock and roll music appeals to both white and black audiences. That leads bigots to brand it seditious and a threat to racial segregation. The rebellious nature of rock only makes America's young people listen all the more. By the time of the 1960 presidential election, rock and roll is a $100 million industry and a huge cultural force. Alan Freed may have been at the forefront of this phenomenon, but none of it happens without the transistor radio and the television set. Rather than the cabinet-sized radio found in most homes of the 1940s and 50s, the advent of the portable handheld transistor in 1954 allows listeners to hear music on AM radio almost anywhere. The invention of the transistor coincides precisely with the birth of rock and roll, as does the growing number of American households owning a TV. In 1954, that number was 65% of U.S. homes. By 1960, that figure has leapt to almost 90%, with many now watching in color instead of black and white. It is typical of television programming at the time to include musical shows once popular on the radio, such as country sensation Grand Ole Opry. In keeping with this theme, Philadelphia TV station WFIL creates American Bandstand. The host is Bob Horn, a radio announcer making his TV debut. But when Horn is removed from the show after being arrested for drunk driving, as well as cavorting with a prostitute, a new host is introduced. That man is Dick Clark, a boyishly handsome radio and television personality who is not yet 30 years old. Clark quickly takes the show national on the ABC network, featuring a stable of regular dancers as well as games like Rate the Record, in which audience members choose the best songs of the day. Featured artists often appear on Bandstand, lip-syncing their hits. As the show explodes in popularity, a single appearance on American Bandstand is enough to make any young entertainer into a star. When black singer Chubby Checker debuts The Twist on August 6, 1960, the dance craze becomes a phenomenon. And the record knocks Elvis Presley's It's Now or Never off the top of the charts. Quickly, rock and roll becomes the leading source of revenue in the music industry, challenging motion pictures for the American dollar. As a result, many top musical performers such as Elvis Presley migrate to Hollywood to make films alongside veteran stars like John Wayne and Bing Crosby, seamlessly blending the two forms of entertainment. Yet, it is not disc jockeys, musicians, or television hosts who benefit most from these transactions. It is organized crime. The mob quietly bankrolls and manages the careers of many singers and songwriters. The more often a record is played on the radio, the more likely it is to become a hit. Thus, payola, bribing a disc jockey to play a record, is an investment that pays dividends in higher royalties, as well as guaranteeing a packed house when an artist performs in a mob-run venue. That's the atmosphere I grew up in when I was a kid, New Jersey native Frankie Valli of the Four Seasons will recall many years later. If you were in the music business, in most cases, all the places you worked for were owned by those guys. Organized crime are the guys who own the bars and nightclubs. I came from a very Italian neighborhood, and there was a lot of organized crime presence. I knew guys who dressed in suits every day and drove Cadillacs and didn't go to work. I didn't know what they did. In Detroit, a 30-year-old songwriter and record producer named Berry Gordy allegedly funds the start of his new Motown record label by borrowing a few thousand dollars from the Detroit Mafia. Angelo, the chairman Melli, is the syndicate's underboss, working as part of the nationwide commission alongside New York's five families. Melli's top lieutenants are his brother Frank and nephew Vince. In addition to labor racketeering, the Melli family owns record labels Meltone Music, White Music Company, and J&C Music, as well as overseeing the local jukebox market and controlling the booking of musicians in local clubs. Footnote: the rumors about Berry Gordy's mafia connections were strong enough that the FBI's Detroit Bureau brought him in for questioning. Now 90 years old at the time of this writing, Gordy continues to deny rumors that the mafia was involved in the founding of Motown Records. He claims the rumors began because he hired an Italian-American to head his sales department. End footnote. In Philadelphia, Bob Marcucci, the son of a labor organizer, looks for local singers to churn out hits. His efforts initially fail. When gangsters claim all the royalties for Marcucci's 1953 song, You Are Mine, the young man leans upon his father for assistance negotiating the world of music and organized crime. Bob Marcucci soon discovers the singers Fabiano Fabian Forte, as well as a trumpet player named Francis Thomas Avalone, who becomes famous as Frankie Avalon. Robert Louis Ridarelli, a Philadelphia singer who performs under the name of Bobby Rydell, is not among Marcucci's clients. He prefers to let his father manage him. But Rydell's connection to organized crime goes right to the top. He was a wonderful man, Rydell will remember of Angelo Bruno, the powerful boss of the Philadelphia crime family. Bruno took over the Philadelphia crime family in 1959 and will rule for 2 decades in a style so opposed to violence that he will become known as the Docile Don. He was a mob figure, but a wonderful man. At one point, Bobby Rydell's father, Adrio, inadvertently double-books his son. One engagement is singing at the Americana Hotel in Miami. The other is making a movie in Australia. When the Americana refuses to postpone Bobby Rydell's performance, placing the film in jeopardy, Adrio Rydell places a call to mob boss Bruno. The results are immediate. There was a phone call made to a particular gentleman in Miami, Rydell will recall, and I went and made the motion picture. I never played the Americana. Footnote. The movie Rydell made in Australia was That Lady from Peking. End footnote. But not every machination within the music world can be solved with a simple phone call. Sometimes the dealings are so complex and duplicitous that they take years to resolve. And it seems the mafia always comes out on the winning end. Morris Levy, who has deep ties with Vito Genovese, owns the famous Birdland nightclub in Manhattan, as well as the Roulette record label. Both businesses are a front for the Genovese family. Levy makes it a practice to secure copyright control of all songs performed in his club. Artists working for Roulette are also expected to grant Levy a songwriting credit, allowing him to receive royalties as both the writer and publisher of a record. For example, the famous hit Why Do Fools Fall in Love was written by a 14-year-old named Frankie Lyman from Harlem. Again, Morris Levy receives a writing credit. Upon Lyman's death at age 25 from a heroin overdose in 1968, Levy has all mention of the singer's name removed from legal documents. Later, when sued by Lyman's widow for back royalties, Levy testifies under oath that he co-wrote the song. Upon being asked how a businessman with no ability to play or read music manages to write a top 40 pop hit, Levy shrugs. You get together, you get the beat together, and you put the music and words together. I think I would be misleading you if I said I wrote songs per se like Chopin. After 3 decades of legal wrangling, Morris Levy and the Genovese family wins the case. The widow of Frankie Lyman walks away with nothing but legal bills. In another instance, when Richie Cordell writes It's Only Love for Tommy James and the Shondells, Levy flexes his power by insisting that unless his name is listed as the co-songwriter, the record will never be released. For the sake of his career, James goes along. We ended up selling 110 million records at Roulette, Tommy James will later admit. Of course, getting paid was impossible. Finally, public outrage about abuses in the music business surfaces in 1960. But it is not the mob that suffers public scandal. Instead, it is disc jockey Alan Freed and American Bandstand's Dick Clark who are asked to speak before a congressional subcommittee investigating payola, a combination of the words payment and Victrola, a once fashionable record player. The act of paying to have an artist's music played on radio and television is not technically illegal. But the notion of success being bought by promoters is disturbing to many, thus the hearings. President Dwight Eisenhower is so offended by one disc jockey's claim that payola is the American way of life that he feels compelled to attack the practice as an issue of public morality. At the time of the House hearings, Alan Freed had already been fired from WINS in 1958 and moved on to WABC in New York, where he was fired in 1959. It was well known he accepted bribes to play songs on his show. Payola had been around since the big band era of the 1930s. but Freed's high profile in the rock and roll world, as well as resistance to the new music by an older generation, made him a target. It did not help Freed's case that he co-wrote Maybelline with Chuck Berry and played the record on his show frequently to ensure it became a hit. In 1962, Freed will plead guilty to a charge of commercial bribery and will receive a suspended sentence. Unable to find work, Freed moves to California, where he drinks himself to death at the age of 43. Dick Clark will be far more fortunate. Despite the heavy mafia influence in the record business, he has come to own 33 different distributors, record labels, and manufacturers. I think the crime I may have committed, if any, is that I made a great deal of money in a short time on a little investment. But that is the record business, Clark tells Congress. Wisely, Dick Clark divests himself from each of these enterprises before testifying in the Payola scandal. He will go on to a long and prosperous life, hosting American Bandstand well into the 21st century. Clark never acknowledges any connections to the mob, any instance in which the mafia might have helped him or altered his business practices, or any awareness that his holdings might have fallen into crime family hands. Obviously, Representative Orrin Harris of Arkansas tells Clark at the close of his testimony, "You're a fine young man." Entertainment is one thing, but power politics is something far more serious. And while the public would be shocked to know that the clean-cut John F. Kennedy and his father Joseph have mob associations that could influence the 1960 presidential election, Americans would be just as incredulous to learn that Richard Nixon has a very good friend in Jimmy Hoffa, the corrupt head of the Teamsters Union. Almost 9 months ago, Hoffa arranged to meet with Oakley Hunter at the Americana Hotel in Miami Beach. Hunter is a Nixon ally, a veteran of the U.S. House of Representatives from California. As Hoffa enters the congressman's suite, he takes off his suit coat to show that he is not wearing a recording wire. Hunter does the same. The two men sit down, and it is soon clear to Oakley Hunter that Jimmy Hoffa's hatred for the Kennedy brothers has not abated. He feels he is being made a scapegoat and a whipping boy, Hunter will write to Richard Nixon in a memo. The Kennedy brothers, Hoffa believes, are young millionaires who had never done a day's work in their lives. Above all, Jimmy Hoffa wants a more conciliatory relationship between the Teamsters and the federal government. Should Nixon be elected president, Hoffa is confident that will happen. But knowing that his personal reputation could harm Richard Nixon, Hoffa delegates Teamster support to local leaders across the country. Along the way, he promises the Nixon confidants that he will deliver the vote of his 1.6 million union members. In addition, Jimmy Hoffa promises that a significant amount of campaign money will flow to Richard Nixon. On September 7, 1960, 2 months before Election Day, Hoffa publicly announces that JFK presents a very real danger to our nation if he is successful in buying our country's highest office. On September 26th, an anonymous donor gives the Nixon for President campaign a suitcase full of $500,000 in unmarked bills and a promise of another $500,000 to come. Footnote: Hoffa aide Ed Parton, who later became a government informant, was present when New Orleans mobster Carlos Marcello presented Jimmy Hoffa with the suitcase. "I was right there, listening to the conversation," Parton will later recount. Marcello had a suitcase filled with $500,000 cash, which was going to Nixon. It was a $500,000 contribution. The other half was coming from the mob boys in New Jersey and Florida. End footnote. In the meantime, in an act of political quid pro quo, Hoffa receives the coincidental news that the Justice Department, led by Republican Attorney General William Rogers, has canceled a pending indictment of Jimmy Hoffa in a Florida case involving fraud with Teamster pensions. We stand today on the edge of a new frontier, John Kennedy states as he accepts his party's nomination. The frontier of the 1960s, a frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, a frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats. The Democratic candidate is speaking about the United States of America. But if the speaker was instead Sam Giancana or Jimmy Hoffa, they could just as easily be talking about organized crime. As the new decade begins to unfold, organized crime seems to be an unstoppable force. The mob has vast influence in movies, gambling, commerce, music, vice, almost every form of transaction and gratification. Criminals control the food delivered to American tables, the restaurants in which the people dine, the hotels where they sleep, and the entertainment they enjoy. As Election Day 1960 draws near, it is a fact that organized crime will attempt to use its vast power to influence who will become the next president of the United States. And few Americans have any idea what is happening. Chapter 16. January 20th, 1961, Washington, D.C., 12:51 p.m. I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear, intones Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren. The president-elect repeats those words back to the jurist. The two men stand on the east portico of the Capitol building, watched by a crowd of nearly 1 million spectators. A severe overnight snowstorm forced the use of flamethrowers to clear the streets, and 1,400 cars stranded by the blizzard had to be towed from Pennsylvania Avenue this morning. Now, even at midday, the temperature, adjusted for wind chill, is just 7 degrees. Yet JFK does not wear an overcoat or hat for his swearing-in, preferring to depict an image of rugged youthfulness. After 8 years under America's eldest president, the 70-year-old Dwight Eisenhower, the nation now has elected one of its youngest. Footnote: Teddy Roosevelt was America's youngest president, but JFK was the nation's youngest elected president. End footnote. As befitting that youth, both of the 43-year-old Kennedy's parents are in attendance, a first in presidential history. 1 mile away, in his office at the Justice Department on Constitution Avenue, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover watches the proceedings on television. Hoover is surrounded by several agents and their families. The mood is festive, despite the fact that Hoover's personal choice in the recent election, Richard Nixon, was not triumphant. J. Edgar Hoover has now been in charge of the Bureau in its many guises since 1925, and despite rumors that he may retire because of JFK's election, Hoover has no plans to step down. And John F. Kennedy will not remove him. "You don't fire God," Kennedy explained to his friends. On this afternoon, Director Hoover is keeping a secret. He is well aware that vote tampering played a key role in JFK's election. FBI wiretaps have provided Hoover with that information and a number of other things that will increase his power. For example, Hoover now has a thick file on Kennedy's extramarital affairs, including detailed accounts of his philandering with Frank Sinatra, as well as the new president's ongoing relationship with Judith Campbell. After analyzing the voluminous material gathered by the FBI during the campaign, Hoover believes Sam Giancana and the outfit in Chicago were able to falsify some votes in JFK's favor. But rather than make these explosive allegations public, the director holds them in reserve to be used when it can benefit him most. The truth is, J. Edgar Hoover does not trust the Kennedy brothers. He is angry with JFK's decision to anoint his 35-year-old brother Attorney General. There is no way J. Edgar Hoover is going to answer to Bobby Kennedy. The job of Attorney General is usually given to someone with vast legal experience, but Robert Kennedy has never tried a case in court or even practiced law. In fact, RFK's primary credentials are a sibling relationship with America's new leader and the fact that Bobby successfully helmed JFK's victorious presidential campaign. So it is that Robert Francis Kennedy is now J. Edgar Hoover's boss. Hoover has worked under five presidents and has been granted unrestricted access to the Oval Office. This has allowed him to undercut attorneys general when necessary in order to advance his personal agenda. But this will be impossible in the new administration. The two brothers will effectively run the nation as a team, with Hoover outside the tent pissing in, to use an expression used by Vice President Lyndon Johnson. Even so, the director is trying to be optimistic about the situation. He recently delivered a five-page letter to the new attorney general, detailing the FBI's investigations into communism in America. Hoover believes this to be the greatest threat to the nation and hopes RFK will allow him to widen the scope of these red inquiries. It is apparent that J. Edgar Hoover does not intend to be subservient. Tour guides at the Justice Department have been instructed to advise visitors that Hoover became head of the Bureau of Investigation the same year Bobby Kennedy was born. In addition, an agent is being posted at the door of the Justice Department gymnasium, ready to prevent access to anyone without official FBI identification, including the fitness-obsessed new attorney general. But for now, surrounded by friends and cronies as he watches John Kennedy complete his oath of office, J. Edgar Hoover is content. The Kennedy brothers may hold electoral power, but the thick dossier he possesses on JFK's sex life is power of a far different nature. The documents are insurance that Hoover will remain director of the FBI for as long as he likes. However, the files are not enough, as Hoover leaves nothing to chance. Anticipating Robert Kennedy's arrival, the director has placed listening devices throughout the Justice Department. Hoover is so determined to undermine the new attorney general's authority that he not only bugs RFK's private elevator, but also arranges for the speed of ascent and descent to be slowed so that the secret discussions can be recorded for longer periods of time. Traps are being set. Bobby Kennedy does not fear J. Edgar Hoover, nor is communism his primary interest. America's new attorney general is eager to hit the ground running, and to RFK, that means greater focus on destroying organized crime. His work during the McClellan hearings has exposed the many tendrils of the mob that permeate American society. In his best-selling 1960 book, The Enemy Within, Kennedy writes, "If we do not, on a national scale, attack organized criminals with weapons and techniques as effective as their own, they will destroy us." In fact, the Wall Street Journal anticipates, "The most sweeping campaign against gangsters, labor racketeers, and vice overlords that the country has ever seen." In other words, the paper believes Bobby Kennedy will go to war with the mob. And he does. In April 1961, after just 3 months in office, he authorizes the Internal Revenue Service to hire a team of new agents to investigate the tax returns of known underworld figures. And that's just the beginning. In a display of ruthless aggression that demonstrates the extent of Kennedy's zeal, he authorizes the deportation of Carlos Marcello, the feared head of the New Orleans crime family. Born in Tunisia, the silk suit-wearing Marcello came to America as an infant, but in adulthood never applied for citizenship. Using this illegal alien status against him, the U.S. Immigration Service handcuffs a surprised 51-year-old Marcello as he tries to renew his residence card. The feds then place him on a black flight to Guatemala, on which he is the only passenger. For reasons that remain unclear, Marcello had previously obtained a fraudulent Guatemalan birth certificate. This provides American officials legal authority to deport the mobster to that nation. The United States has been trying for a decade to deport Marcello, but until now, no country would take this legendary criminal. But this time is different. The process begins when the Justice Department learns through an informant that Marcello has arranged for a forger to doctor Guatemalan birth records. The Central Intelligence Agency, which has been active in propping up the Guatemalan military regime, receives orders to search for irregularities in the official recording of births in the San Jose Pinula region. There, they find the phony register. The U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Agency then uses this evidence to obtain an official entry permit from the Guatemalan government. Marcello's woes do not end with his arrival in Central America. Not wanting him in their country, Guatemalan authorities apprehend the gangster for holding false citizenship papers. He is then driven into neighboring El Salvador under the cover of darkness, where he is released at a military camp. The soldiers quickly place Marcello on a bus to neighboring Honduras. After a lengthy journey through the jungle, chased by local men seeking to rob and perhaps murder him, Marcello finally reaches an airport where he arranges a military flight to Miami through his good friend Rafael Trujillo, dictator of the Dominican Republic. From Miami, the gangster takes a commercial flight to New Orleans, where he is promptly rearrested for illegally entering the United States and also served with an $835,000 tax lien. But Carlos Marcello is allowed to remain in the United States as his lawyers fight the charges. All the while, Marcello seethes and plots against the Kennedy brothers, swearing he will get his revenge. Bobby Kennedy is livid that Marcello is back in America. But as the New Orleans courts debate the mobster's future, the Attorney General has other things to do. Kennedy sends a team of 50 lawyers to Chicago as a special prosecution unit against the outfit. In June, the Justice Department hands down 13 gambling indictments. In July, RFK is successful in getting 4 anti-crime bills passed, which stiffen penalties against racketeering and illicit wagering. The Attorney General is present in the Oval Office when his older brother signs the Interstate Wire Act of 1961, also called the Federal Wire Act, allowing the feds to secretly monitor gambling activity. All of this, of course, is cutting into the mob's profits. Behind the scenes, Bobby Kennedy's hopes of establishing a national crime commission are opposed by J. Edgar Hoover. So Kennedy authorizes the Justice Department's Organized Crime and Racketeering Section to gather information on known mob activities, bypassing the FBI. Data collected by 27 government agencies is now controlled by Kennedy. The results are almost immediate. In 1961 alone, prosecution of underworld figures nets 11 major convictions, including that of longtime Los Angeles boss Mickey Cohen. In addition, the Justice Department breaks up an international heroin smuggling ring known as the French Connection, winning 11 convictions in the process. Footnote: the French Connection was the conduit for smuggling heroin into the United States and Canada from Turkey through France. First begun in 1937, the Corsican-led operation was protected by the American Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, precursor to the CIA, during World War II, in exchange for helping defeat French communism. Many members of the drug ring also served in the French resistance during the war, leading to later rumors that French police were unwilling to prosecute them as thanks for their service. Despite the convictions obtained by Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department, the French Connection continued to operate into the 1970s. In 1971, a movie by the same name starring Gene Hackman became a major hit. End footnote. Impressed by this success, Congress doubles the Justice Department's budget for fighting organized crime. J. Edgar Hoover does not like any of this, and is especially offended when RFK visits the FBI field office in Chicago. The visit takes place in October 1961. Agents ask if the Attorney General is interested in hearing wiretaps of local mafiosi discussing a recent crime. Kennedy eagerly agrees. On the tapes, the murder of a 350-pound mob juice man slang for debt collector, is discussed in detail by the men who did the killing. William Action Jackson is no saint. In the course of his work, he is fond of breaking into the homes of men who fall behind on their debts, then raping their wives as a reminder to pay up. He is arrested in the summer of 1961 while attempting to unload stolen electrical appliances in a warehouse. His five accomplices all manage to flee, but Jackson is too heavy to run. While in custody, the debt collector is asked to become a federal informant. As a lifelong member of the outfit, Jackson refuses. But the Juice Man's story is not believed by his fellow mobsters, who in their paranoia think he's an informer. 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy listens to the killers brutally describe how Jackson is kidnapped and taken to a Chicago meat plant. The giant man is stripped. His hands and feet are bound with rope. A meat hook is inserted into his rectum. His kneecaps are broken with a baseball bat, then his ribs. A sharp object is shoved into one ear, poking a hole in the drum. An electrical cattle prod is then shoved into his genitals. Jackson still refuses to confess to being an informer, so his brutalizers use a blowtorch to incinerate his penis. Only then is he taken off the meat hook. The murderers leave the big man bound to bleed to death, a passing that does not take place for 3 long days. In all his years of congressional hearings, Bobby Kennedy has never heard such depravity. He knows of murders and corruption, but this barbarity is too difficult for him to immediately process. The FBI agents will report to J. Edgar Hoover that a shocked Kennedy flushes with rage before he abruptly leaves their office. As RFK flies back to Washington to continue his crusade against organized crime, he is well aware that the outfit can murder almost anyone at any time they choose. Even Robert Francis Kennedy. If 1961 is triumphant for Bobby Kennedy, the same cannot be said of 1962. It is on December 11, 1961, that the success of the Attorney General's first year begins crashing down. J. Edgar Hoover writes a succinct memo to his boss, revealing the contents of a Sam Giancana wiretap. The mobster is overheard lamenting that his efforts to get John Kennedy elected have not resulted in less pressure on the outfit. Nor has there been any significant attempt to get rid of Fidel Castro and return the mafia to control of the Havana casinos. In fact, because of Bobby Kennedy, the scrutiny of mob crimes has intensified. Giancana then boasts that he will find a way to use his relationship with Patriarch Joseph Kennedy to keep the Justice Department at bay, admitting on tape that he secretly and illegally funneled a large donation to the Kennedy campaign through the father to help JFK win the West Virginia primary. Frank Sinatra is one of the go-betweens delivering the cash. Footnote: the FBI had listening devices planted in the Chicago First Ward Democratic Organization, codenamed Shade, in the outfit's Michigan Avenue hangout, Little Al, and in Sam Giancana's Armory Lounge, Mo. Though providing valuable intelligence, the surveillance was in violation of the Fourth Amendment, prohibiting unreasonable search and seizure, and thus kept highly classified. End footnote. For the first time, the director of the FBI now has evidence that there is a connection between the Kennedy family and organized crime, at least in allegation form. This is big. Sam Giancana's criminal empire now dwarfs that of all New York's 5 families combined. His enduring relationship with Johnny Roselli continues Giancana's control of Las Vegas and Hollywood. Both Kennedy brothers would be disgraced and forced out of office if the American public knew that the most powerful crime boss in the country had influence over them. Thus, J. Edgar Hoover's memo to Bobby Kennedy is a cryptic threat that he could use the Giancana tap to bring down the Kennedys, should that become necessary. Hoover writes in the memo, Giancana made a donation to the campaign of President Kennedy, but was not getting his money's worth. Footnote: John F. Kennedy never acknowledged any mob interference in the presidential election of 1960, and to this day, allegations remain just that, allegations. End footnote. This is the first time that Bobby Kennedy learns about any association between his father and Sam Giancana. Prior to this, the Attorney General believed that Joseph Kennedy wanted him to avoid organized crime controversies in order to court the labor vote. Knowing that his father may be more involved with organized crime is deeply disturbing to RFK. What happens next is unclear. Bobby and his father often have heated discussions about sensitive matters, such as their blowout over the McClellan hearings 3 years ago. So it is more than likely that after being briefed by Hoover, the new Attorney General brings the Giancana issue to his father. Joseph Kennedy is vacationing at the family compound in Palm Beach, and Bobby is in Washington, so the discussion, if it happened, is by telephone. On December 18th, just 1 week after Hoover's memo is sent to Bobby Kennedy, a severe stroke immobilizes the 73-year-old patriarch. Paralyzed on the right side of his body and afflicted with aphasia, the elder Kennedy will never speak again. A stroke is brought on by soaring blood pressure and ensuing blood vessel ruptures that cause a stoppage of blood flow to the brain. Whatever brought all that on, in Joseph Kennedy's case, will never be known. What is known is that the patriarch no longer possesses the ability to dictate family strategy, leaving John and Robert Kennedy to chart their own paths for the first time in their lives. Yet Joseph Kennedy is not dead, nor is the connection with organized crime that J. Edgar Hoover has in his possession. On February 27, 1962, the director sends another memo to Bobby Kennedy, this time referencing the 70 calls made to the White House by one Judith Campbell. Gleefully, Hoover tells the Attorney General that this 27-year-old beauty is a known companion of Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli. The FBI has long tapped the phone lines in Roselli's Los Angeles apartment, where Campbell often stays when the gangster is out of town. The tap provides Hoover with transcripts of all conversations made from that apartment to the White House. Bobby Kennedy knows he and his brother are in dangerous territory. Not only does the director of the FBI know that JFK is cheating on his wife, but he also knows that Sam Giancana says he helped get the president elected. Emboldened, Hoover places a call to an associate of Walter Winchell, the legendary gossip columnist. He feeds an anonymous item about Judith Campbell as topic number one in romantic political circles. The Kennedy brothers get the message. Under normal circumstances, a connection between a high-ranking individual and organized crime would warrant a criminal investigation. Instead, J. Edgar Hoover practices a form of blackmail. He places these nuggets of information in the personal file of John F. Kennedy. The director is 66 now, a year past suggested retirement age for civil servants. But the Bureau is his life's work, and he has no intention of retiring. With these explosive files, Hoover believes he doesn't have anything to worry about. And while John Kennedy can be flippant about his private indiscretions, often acting as if they have no bearing on his presidency, he now takes immediate action to address Hoover's memos. 2 years after his first association with Judith Campbell, the president instructs his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, that he will no longer take Campbell's phone calls. Footnote: the racist J. Edgar Hoover made wide use of the FBI's phone surveillance, both legal and illegal. In addition to gathering information about Sam Giancana and Judith Campbell, he also tapped Martin Luther King's telephone. Because Hoover had damaging information on the Kennedy family, Bobby reluctantly allowed the wiretapping that led to damaging personal information about Dr. King. End footnote. Judith Campbell is out. So is Frank Sinatra. The entertainer who arranged for both John Kennedy and Sam Giancana to share Judith Campbell claims to be one of the president's best friends. Yet his allegiance to the mob runs far deeper. In an attempt to gain even more influence with the Kennedys, the singer is now having an affair with Patricia Lawford, JFK's sister and wife of fellow Rat Pack member Peter Lawford. Sinatra still reveres Kennedy, but is now in dangerous waters. The singer is insisting that JFK stay at his palatial Palm Springs home in the Tamarisk Country Club, with its orange furnishings, movie theater, and enormous swimming pool. In anticipation of the president's arrival, Sinatra has even installed a new helipad, cottages for the Secret Service, and a telephone switchboard featuring 25 lines, fit for the most powerful man on earth. But J. Edgar Hoover once again inserts himself into the situation, this time by playing Bobby Kennedy wiretaps of a conversation between Sam Giancana and Frank Sinatra. The mobster is clearly disappointed with the singer, who promised to influence the Kennedy family to obtain more lenient treatment of organized crime. Giancana believes Sinatra has lied to him about his discussions with Bobby Kennedy and is actually considering a mob-style murder as revenge. "Don't worry about it. If I can't talk to the old man, I'm going to talk to the man," Sinatra tells Giancana about Bobby Kennedy's relentless attacks on the mafia, making reference to Joseph Kennedy and then JFK. In fact, before the patriarch's stroke, Frank Sinatra had met with him on three separate occasions to suggest that the president and attorney general back off from the mob. Footnote: the meetings were chronicled in a December 1961 FBI wiretap on the Giancana operation. End footnote. But Sinatra's efforts really didn't matter. Only results would do. FBI wiretaps reveal that Giancana is deeply conflicted about having Sinatra murdered. If it was any other individual, the hit would be made immediately. But the mafioso is so enchanted by Sinatra's singing voice that he cannot imagine a world without it. "I'm fucking Phyllis McGuire, playing Sinatra songs in the background, and the whole time I'm thinking to myself, 'Christ, how can I silence that voice?'" Giancana admits to a fellow mobster. So Frank Sinatra continues doing everything he can to please Sam Giancana. One FBI wiretap overhears the singer speaking in vulgar language as he displays his fealty toward the mobster, making it clear that Giancana is the friend he wishes to please most, even more than the president. Sinatra insists that he is taking extreme measures to obtain greater influence with the Kennedy brothers and their war on organized crime. In addition, Sinatra tells Giancana about his affair with Patricia Kennedy Lawford and vows to sleep with this goddamn bitch until I get something going. The FBI tape is shocking. When informed of it by his brother, President Kennedy immediately cuts off Sinatra. He asks Peter Lawford to phone the singer and inform him that he will not be staying at his house in Palm Springs. Instead, he will spend the night at Bing Crosby's Silver Spur Ranch, where actress Marilyn Monroe will be present. Footnote: the official version of events is that the Secret Service preferred Crosby's home because there were only four homes on the 16-acre Silver Spur parcel, with just one gate leading in and out, allowing greater security. As he would in Dallas just a little over a year later, the president traveled around town during his weekend stay in the back seat of an open-air Lincoln convertible, giving little thought to security. End footnote. Upon hearing the bad news, a furious Sinatra steps outside his home, sledgehammer in hand. He then personally begins reducing the helipad to rubble, blow by blow. John and Robert Kennedy know that J. Edgar Hoover can destroy them. But there is little they can do other than avoid Campbell, Giancana, and Sinatra. Try as they might, the Kennedy brothers cannot definitively break the link to organized crime. And in the summer of 1962, the mob connection becomes ever more outrageous. Attorney General Bobby Kennedy is quietly informed by officials of the Central Intelligence Agency that the government has enlisted the aid of Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli to assassinate Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. The plan was not originally hatched during the Kennedy administration. President Dwight Eisenhower had advocated a mafia hit on Castro years before. President Kennedy was told of the mission and gave his approval upon taking office. Bobby Kennedy is also aware of the plot and backs it enthusiastically. The mob is the perfect group to manage such a killing, which would allow the Kennedy administration to disavow any participation. Sam Giancana's outfit is so eager to see Fidel Castro dead that Johnny Roselli and Giancana initially turned down the CIA's offer of $150,000 to perform the hit. The gangsters want to do it for free. They despise Castro that much. Footnote: Giancana foresees a return of mob dominance in Cuba once Castro is killed. End footnote. Initially, the CIA preferred a gangland murder utilizing gunfire, but no mobster would take the job on because the chances of escape are non-existent. Instead, the mob decides to use poison, based on the knowledge that Fidel Castro frequently drinks tea, coffee, and bouillon. The operation had two phases, the official CIA report will document. The first ran from August 1960 until late April or early May 1961, when it was called off following the Bay of Pigs. Footnote: the Bay of Pigs was an attempt by the United States government to overthrow the Castro regime by landing an army of Cuban freedom fighters on the beaches of the same name. The mission was a catastrophe. Almost all the guerrillas were captured or killed, and the Kennedy administration was forced to admit culpability in this attempted invasion of a sovereign nation. End footnote. But that bungled CIA operation did not stop the plot against Castro. Instead, it was a monumental blunder taking place in a Las Vegas hotel room. It all begins when Sam Giancana suspects that his girlfriend, singer Phyllis McGuire, is having an affair with comedian Dan Rowan. Giancana asks former FBI agent Robert Mayhew, who now works as the mob's liaison with the CIA, to place a wiretap in Rowan's Las Vegas hotel room to confirm whether or not the affair is taking place. Hoping to keep the mobster happy, the 44-year-old Mayhew agrees. In the name of discretion, he does not do the job himself, but arranges for a private investigator named Arthur Belletti to plant the bug. Dan Rowan is staying at the Riviera Hotel on the Las Vegas Strip. Belletti successfully places the device and then spends the next week eavesdropping. But as he takes a lunch break one afternoon, Belletti forgets to hang the Do Not Disturb sign. A hotel maid entering to clean Belletti's room grows suspicious when she sees a suitcase full of transmitters, wiring, receivers, and other listening devices. Notes detailing Rowan's conversations are also left in the open. The Las Vegas Sheriff's Department is notified, and Belletti is arrested. The next morning, Rowan requests that all charges be dropped. It is assumed he was coerced. Footnote: Dan Rowan will later go on to fame with his partner Dick Martin in the hit show Laugh-In. End footnote. But J. Edgar Hoover is now on the case. Seeking advantage, he asks to have Belletti prosecuted in open court for the federal offense of wiretapping. He believes there is evidence to implicate Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli, perhaps tying them to the Kennedy brothers. The CIA steps in, protesting that Belletti's behavior is a matter of national security. Simultaneously, the murder plan against Castro is quietly shut down. But the CIA will not stop. In May 1962, the agency revives the assassination scheme. Director Hoover is still trying to prosecute Belletti, leading to tense negotiations among the CIA, FBI, and the Justice Department. On May 7th, Bobby Kennedy is briefed about the situation. If you could have seen Mr. Kennedy's eyes get steely and his jaw set and his voice get low and precise, you get a definite feeling of unhappiness, CIA General Counsel Lawrence Houston will remember. The Attorney General's dismay has little to do with the wiretap. He does not want Sam Giancana exposed in the Castro situation because he knows the mobster could implicate the Kennedys in all kinds of things. I trust that if you will ever try to do business with organized crime, with gangsters, you will tell the Attorney General. Bobby Kennedy orders the federal agents who have come to brief him on the Las Vegas matter. RFK quickly covers his tracks by drafting a memo stating that the Justice Department must no longer participate in any CIA activities. 2 days later, Kennedy meets with Director Hoover to express his astonishment about the CIA aligning with the mob. But the damage is done. And there is more to come. Sam Giancana has another plan. The mob boss remains angry that his secret payoff to get JFK elected has done nothing to ease pressure on the mob. Giancana is also still of the belief that sleeping with a man's lover gives him personal power over that individual. Giancana now sets his sights on bedding another Kennedy consort, 35-year-old actress Marilyn Monroe. Frank Sinatra has assured Giancana that the president is sleeping with the troubled Hollywood star. On May 19, 1962, at a gala Madison Square Garden celebration, Marilyn Monroe publicly and somewhat scandalously serenades John Kennedy with a breathy version of Happy Birthday. The actress is just months removed from divorcing playwright Arthur Miller, her third husband. Dressed in a backless sequined dress so skin-tight that she had to be hoisted into it and wearing absolutely nothing beneath the gown, Monroe's slinky performance is a very public signal of her desire for the president. The display reaffirms Monroe's sex symbol status at a time when age and her personal addictions are slowing a once promising career. She has, in fact, risked her livelihood to be in New York City. Monroe abruptly took time away from filming the movie Something's Got to Give to fly from Hollywood, much to the consternation of its producers. Famously self-destructive, fond of mixing alcohol with pills, Marilyn Monroe returns home to Hollywood and begins a steady downward spiral that lasts well into July. She will be fired from the motion picture upon her return and sued for damages. Marilyn will never again make another film. To some, this sad decline engenders sympathy. But to Sam Giancana, it presents opportunity. Making the actress even more desirable to the mobster is innuendo that Bobby Kennedy has become an ardent admirer. Footnote. Rumors about an affair between Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe have persisted for a half century. In the 1970s, the FBI declared the rumors utterly false. The authors of this book have not been able to confirm any liaisons between Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe, despite writing Killing Kennedy and Killing the Mob. End footnote. So 4 months after the Palm Springs falling out between JFK and Sinatra, Sam Giancana sets a trap. Among the mobster's personal landholdings is a resort on the state line dividing California and Nevada. Appropriately, the casino is named Cal Neva. But Giancana's name is not listed on the deed. Instead, it is Frank Sinatra who publicly owns this gambling den on the shore of Lake Tahoe. In addition to having an affair with Patricia Kennedy Lawford, the singer has ended his relationship with her Rat Pack husband Peter over the Palm Springs JFK fiasco. And yet, for reasons unexplained, Sinatra now thaws that relationship and invites the Lawford couple to spend a few summer days at Cal Neva. Patricia Lawford knows that Marilyn Monroe has been quietly informed to stay away from the Kennedys by Bobby and other top insiders. She refuses. The president no longer takes her phone calls, but the actress still has limited access to RFK. Monroe is upset about JFK ending the affair, and there are fears she will damage the 1964 re-election campaign by speaking to the press. Patricia Lawford hopes to calm Marilyn down. So now, at the behest of Frank Sinatra, she invites the actress to join her at Cal Neva. Marilyn Monroe had stayed there a year ago while filming The Misfits with Montgomery Clift and Clark Gable in the nearby Nevada desert. The film would be the last for the legendary Gable, who died soon afterward. Monroe herself flirted with death during the production, her dependence upon barbiturates so strong that filming was stopped for a week so she might detox. The actress's return to Cal Neva is anything but restful. "I was there in 62, Las Vegas boss and partner of Meyer Lansky, Vincent Jimmy Blue Eyes Allo, will recall. Peter and Frank were there with Monroe. They kept her drugged every night. It was disgusting." Eyewitnesses will state that a photographer recorded much of the activity, with Monroe so completely under the influence of narcotics that she appears to be passed out. They will also describe the actress leaning over a toilet covered with vomit as Sam Giancana kneels behind her, grinning for the camera. FBI agent William Romer of the Chicago office will later listen to wiretap recordings of Giancana and Roselli discussing the goings-on in Bungalow 52. "There, I had put together, she engaged in an orgy. From the conversation I overheard, it appeared she may have had sex with both Sinatra and Giancana on the same trip," Romer will conclude. Confirming that Sam Giancana had his way with Monroe, then bragged about it, FBI wiretaps will record Johnny Roselli's incredulous response to Giancana's relentless boasting. "You sure get your rocks off fucking the same broads as the brothers, don't you?" 1 week later, Marilyn Monroe ingests a lethal overdose of chloral hydrate and pentobarbital in the bedroom of her Los Angeles home. The barbiturates slow her heart and lungs until they stop altogether. By 10:30 p.m. on August 4, 1962, Marilyn Monroe is dead. Sam Giancana seems to have gotten away with yet another atrocity. But his luck is about to change. Chapter 17. June 22, 1962, U.S. Federal Penitentiary, Atlanta, Georgia, 7:30.